Welcome to All the Things with Monique Dusson from the Center for Biblical Unity and Theology Mom, Krista Bontrager. And now, here's Krista and Monique.
Hello, and welcome to All the Things. I am Monique Dusson.
And I am Krista Bontrager, also known as Theology Mom.
This is the show where we talk about all the things related to God, the Bible, and real life. Welcome. We are very excited to have you. How have you been?
Good. You're making me nervous there, typing until the very last second.
You guys, I will do anything up until the last second. Don't play no games. Because I feel like I can always beat the timer. I might have a lot of confidence in myself. Apparently, she doesn't. But that's okay. We'll just keep going.
But we are live. We haven't been live in a while. Well, we were live last week, I guess.
We were live last week
because you were back from Africa. So if people missed our whole backstory about you being a missionary in South Africa and then going back, we've been keeping it a big secret about you being in Africa. So if you missed all of that, go back to last week's show. It really was kind of the first time we've talked about the whole story.
Yeah, it's the first time that we've talked about the whole story and like why I moved home and things like that. And so I thought it was a good show. My friends in South Africa watched it and they thought it was a good show. So yeah.
Oh, they approved.
Okay. Yeah.
That's good.
I mean, I need their approval. I'm talking about their nation.
I know.
So yeah, I'm just saying. Yes, yes. My hair is crazy.
We're doing the natural thing today.
I apologize, friends. I apologize.
So make sure you are subscribed to the All the Things digital newsletter. We send it out each week. We're going to have a show. So if you're wondering, like, when are they live and when are they having a show and all of that, just make sure you're signed up for the newsletter and you will get it delivered to your inbox on Friday before the show. Next week, we will be dark because it is Holy Saturday. And we will be off.
I thought we were celebrating your birthday. That's why we was dark. Never mind.
Don't be putting my birthday out there like
that. Her birthday's on Sunday, y'all.
It's on Easter this year.
Easter.
Mm-hmm. Only happens every so often.
Yes, yes, yes. So tonight's show is brought to you by the Center for Biblical Unity, Theology Mom Podcast, Family 210 Clothing, and Impact 360.
Impact 360.
Yes, yes.
So tonight we have a very special guest
that she is very excited about. Listen, I'm just going to put it out there right now. If y'all don't hear me talk a lot, it's not because I don't want to talk. I just know that Krista already has some thoughts and her thoughts have thoughts. Like Krista's the person where it's like, I'm going down one path, but then her thoughts just kind of all in. And so if I'm just sitting here, trust me, I'm learning just like you. It is okay. I'm not feeling uncomfortable personally. So yes, we are talking about the WEF, the World Economic Forum.
Yeah. And we have Dr. Jay Richards on to do it. And I'm so excited because both the topic and our guest, I've been trying to get Dr. Richards on for a few years now. I just haven't been able to find quite the right email address to get through to him. So we saw him at an event last fall and I said, I'm going to go ask him right now.
No, that is not how it went. She was like, oh my gosh, that's Jay Richards. Now y'all know me. I'm from the other side of the track. So I was like, who? I'm not in the realm of academia and all that. And I'm still trying to get my life right. Okay. Yeah. And so she explained and I was like, oh my gosh, like we want to talk about the WEF and all of that. And so I was like, go talk to him. And she was like, I cannot.
You're really putting me out there like that, aren't you?
It's okay. I know I will have my day.
I'm pretty excited.
So yes. So you asked him and he was like, oh, of course.
Yeah. He was like, I'll do that. So
and she was like, well, that was easy. That's a good conversation.
Yeah, no, it's good. Jay and I have known each other as like passing acquaintances for about 25 years. I first learned about his work when I went to a special weekend with the Acton Institute way back when I was in my early 20s. And they referred us to his work. And that was how I first found out about him and then followed him when he worked at the Discovery Institute because I was working at Reasons to Believe. And sometimes we would be co-platformed at conferences and stuff together. We interviewed him for a documentary that my husband and I did a long, long, long time ago, and just have followed him over the years and really respected him as a quality scholar. And
that's awesome.
In a variety of ways. So I know he's going to be new for some people, but I'm super excited to be able to introduce people to his very fine work. And he's written a new book, and we will talk about that
yes, yes.
at the end. So with that, let's get him on and talk about the World Economic Forum, the thing that sounds like a conspiracy, but is actually real.
Yes.
Welcome, Jay.
Hello.
Okay, it's good to see you both. And yeah, I appreciate that backstory about when we talked this fall, actually. And so I'm glad we finally synced our schedule so that we could do this.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us and talking about the World Economic Forum. There are a lot of people who will refuse to talk about the World Economic Forum. Mm-hmm. And so we just appreciate your boldness and coming on to help bring clarity to this conversation. For those who don't know of your work, who you may be new to, can you give us a bit of just your story? Who are you? What is the work that you do?
Yeah, gosh, if I'm going to do it in 30 seconds, I'd say I'm a sort of shameless generalist. As Krista mentioned, I've been affiliated actually with the Discovery Institute way back since 1998. But I'm now full-time actually as a director of the DeVos Center and a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, which is a public policy think tank actually here right in Washington, D.C. I would say to sort of summarize what I've done over the last 25 years is I tried to work at the intersection of the Christian worldview and Christian theology and some kind of public issue, whether it's science and faith or it's faith and theology and economics, or just the kind of intersection of ethics and politics. And so I like being at the sort of boundary between faith and some kind of public aspect of that. And I also like to try to translate academic ideas for a general audience rather than just sort of burrowing into a corner somewhere like an academic. So I've mostly been in think tanks. I taught for 7 years in the business school at Catholic University, but I'm now full-time actually here at the Heritage Foundation.
Wow. I kind of feel like you and Krista must just came out the womb, like landed on the planet doing work. Like, y'all, you know, since I was 7, I was teaching in academia and then I started in ministry. You guys, I personally am not there, but I think that that's awesome for y'all. So I have learned much about the WEF and much about who you are from Krista. And so to help bring all of us up to speed on what the WEF is specifically, because I thought I knew, and then Krista mm-hmm. gave some more insight and shared some of your work with me. Can you tell us exactly what the WEF is? I know that they met recently in Switzerland. I think it was when that chicken girl was like coughing on people. That's what it was. Let's be honest.
That did happen. Yeah,
it did happen. And so what is the WEF? And like, when did it start? What is their main purpose and goal on the planet?
Well, so their main purpose, if you just take the kind of official marketing statement, is to make the world a better place, effectively. It was started actually initially way back in 1971 by Klaus Schwab, who was an engineer, an economist, and really a business professor more than anything else at the University of Geneva. Started in 1971 really as a way to bring together leaders in civil society, think, you know, sort of philanthropists or retired business people, major CEOs of corporations, and then heads of state. And so the idea is that we don't want a world where people are competing against each other for resources and land and things like that. We want a world where everyone's cooperating. And so his idea was to bring powerful, influential people, really elites, from around the world to meet together. And it's in this beautiful place called Davos, Switzerland, which is in eastern Switzerland. It's a beautiful, very tony resort town. And so it always happens in the winter there. It's a ski resort. As it happens, I don't know if you guys know this, my president at the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, was surprisingly asked to speak at the World Economic Forum. And this is something that just sort of happened at the last minute. We had this kind of internal discussion. Well, why are they doing that? And thought, well, are they trying to co-opt us or something like that? But I think they started realizing, I think they're feeling the heat of criticism directed toward them from both the left and the right. And they thought, okay, well, let's invite Kevin Roberts, who's the head of the kind of flagship conservative think tank, to speak. And we'll invite this new radical libertarian president from Argentina to speak. And Dr. Roberts did an amazing job, I think, of saying why it is that serious conservatives have a problem with the World Economic Forum when he was there. But that's the kind of easiest way without diving into the kind of sinister aspects, I think, of the work of the World Economic Forum. Think of it as a really fancy convening organization for bringing elites from around the world together at $19,000 per ticket. That's what it is.
That's a good kind of, like you said, marketing summary. In fact, I'm going to have Bob play a 90-second clip from the World Economic Forum so we can hear it in their own words. I think you did a really accurate job of depicting it, but this kind of gives a little bit of the verbiage and how they talk about themselves. Mm-hmm. So Bob's going to play a little highlight from their Our Story video.
There's a lot of really interesting big questions that I think we have to face in the world. Helping answer some of those big questions, providing a platform for others to answer those big questions. This is now an open space for a lot of our constituents to truly drive forward their own actions.
I'm passionate about serving a group of alternative thinkers who have not only dreamt up great ideas about how the world can be more fair, more inclusive, more just, more sustainable, but are actually proving it's possible.
If you go back 50 years to the time when the forum was conceived, the whole idea was to make the multi-stakeholder concept come alive.
The world has become so interdependent that entrepreneurs everywhere in the world depend each on another.
If you look at the history of the forum, it's really been defining systems thinking.
For example, the Gavi Vaccine Alliance. It took bringing all these great minds with resources together to say, what can we do about this?
Today, we're announcing that we'll spend over $10 billion over this next decade on vaccines.
Trust really gives us our credibility. It's really the essential piece to ensuring that we can continue to do the work that we do.
The forum managed to convince Mandela and de Klerk to try and to reintegrate South Africa post-apartheid.
It has been my great privilege to fight a struggle for freedom that the world adopted.
And the ability of the forum to have good convening power, to bring all relevant actors to the table, and to be able to do it in a way that can impact entire countries or entire domestic systems.
Okay, so that gives people a little flavor of the verbiage. I mean, we hear him say, try to bring about a more just, a more inclusive, fair world. They want to work with alternative thinkers. They mm-hmm. want to work with people, you know, that are world leaders. We saw Yasser Arafat. We saw Nelson Mandela. I'm sure Monique has some thoughts about the South African project there and how successful that was. But what we need to know is that this is not a new thing that was just invented 5 years ago. This is something that has been around for a while, but they really want to make us believe that they want to make the world a better place according to their vision of it.
I thought it was interesting that they used the word serve. Like they want to serve mm-hmm. the world's right. people. And can we define our terms?
Yeah.
That's
is that a menu? What do you mean, sir?
Like, what do you mean by all of these terms? What do you mean by inclusive? What do you
There's
mean by-
There's a lot of coded language here. Maybe you can help us kind of decode some of this.
Absolutely. I mean, so notice the language of interdependence. They'll use words like entrepreneurship and creativity. The idea that they bring a forum for alternative thinkers I think that's the most laughable. They absolutely do not do that. I mean, if you're alternative thinkers, so maybe the dissenters from the COVID lockdowns, did they platform those people? No. I mean, the reality is that what they tend to platform and to hold up are utterly conventional, secular, progressive kind of European transnational elites over and over and over again. What was interesting about the 2024 meeting is the fact that they actually did invite a couple of people that were willing to actually criticize them. But the truth of the matter is that for decades, what they've been doing is bringing together what I would call the kind of transnational elites, people like Bill Gates, people like leaders in the European Union or in the United Nations, who I think inside their heads certainly imagine that what they want to do is to make the world a better place. It's just that when you actually look at the details, it usually means In their case, actually, basically much greater social control, not just for the state or for the United Nations, but for these transnational corporations. Notice that like at the UN, that's just a forum for heads of states and the missions to the UN of different countries. The World Economic Forum brings together the largest philanthropists, so in the kind of nonprofit sector in the United States, CEOs of massive corporations, many of them transnational, and then heads of state all together. And I think that's the best way to understand what the World Economic Forum is and what it represents, is this kind of alternative movement. Whereas if you think about the 20th century as the sort of fight between the free world and communism, and in communism, say in the Soviet Union, you had the state completely dominating and absorbing society as a whole, so that Lenin nationalized the farms and nationalized the factories so that they're entirely controlled by the government. The World Economic Forum and this kind of progressive elite in the 21st century, that is not what they are about. They're not about nationalizing everything so it's controlled by a single unitary state. What they want is a kind of a big blob of these transnational corporations and governments and elites in the civil society sector all working together and cooperating. That might sound nice, but the effect of it is still a group of detached elites that are sort of telling everybody else what to do.
And in our system of government, they would be unelected people who would be having potentially a profound impact on how we do certain things in our country. We have another little short video. There's no sound, but I'm going to have Bob play it, that kind of gives more of the picture of the world as the WEF might conceive of it. It says, this is from a tweet from 2016.
You'll own nothing and you'll be happy.
Yeah. So they've been around a while. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. You'll go back a little bit, Bob, to the beginning. Predictions. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. This is how the world could change by 2030. And you hear that year a lot, 2030. Whatever you want, you'll rent and it'll be delivered by drone.
The devil is a lie.
The U.S. won't be the world's leading superpower. A handful of countries will dominate. You won't die waiting for an organ donor. We won't transplant organs. We'll print new ones. And there's a 3D printer making a new organ. You'll eat much less meat.
Now that is from the devil.
an occasional treat, not a staple, for the good of the environment and our health. Number five, 1 billion people will be displaced by climate change. We'll have to do a better job of welcoming and integrating refugees. That's kind of interesting. Number six, polluters will have to pay to emit carbon dioxide. So this is a carbon dioxide tax that we hear about now. There will be a global price on carbon. This will help make fossil fuels history. So the elimination of fossil fuels. Number seven, you could be preparing to go to Mars. Scientists will have worked out how to keep you healthy in space, the start of a journey to find alien life. Number eight, Western values will have been tested to the breaking point.
That's also keywords for whiteness.
Checks and balances that underpin our democracies must not be forgotten. It's very interesting. So those are the eight changes and kind of their vision for the world. But each of those policies has far-reaching implications.
Yeah, they do. And I think it's important. It's funny because a lot of that stuff actually comes or is at least in Klaus Schwab's 2016 book, The Fourth Industrial Revolution. He didn't make up that term, but he sort of popularized it. Actually wrote about a lot of the same subjects in a 2018 book called The Human Advantage, about the sort of coming revolution in automation and robots and artificial intelligence and interconnectivity and things like that. And so some of those things are actually just things that Schwab or people that are around him are predicting are going to happen. So that you won't own anything, or you'll just rent things and you'll be happy. That sounds communist. What they're actually saying is that, let me give you an example. is that, let's say you have a world in which all the cars are all autonomous, so that you don't actually, you can just sit in the cars, you can summon it when you want. Suddenly you don't really need to own a car. If you live in an urban environment, you just summon a car whenever you need it. It'd pick you up, take you where you want to go. And then you wouldn't have to have it sitting in your garage, not doing anything 95% of the time. So that's a, those are sort of predictions that certain technological futurists are making. But then some of those other things, notice, are very specific claims having to do, say, with climate change. This idea that a billion people are going to be refugees because of climate change in 2030, that's just insane. There is just absolutely no reason to think that that would be true. But a lot of the messaging of the World Economic Forum, notice, leans heavily on this idea of an impending climate catastrophe that's going to require us to completely transform the main source of energy that we have right now. And so that's where you want to get really skeptical, because in order to have that happen, okay, look, the reality is, we use hydrocarbons right now for as our primary source of energy because it's abundant, it's inexpensive, and it's a really energy-dense form of energy. It makes the most sense. If we had an alternative to that, we'd be using that. And so getting everyone to quit using the best form of energy for most uses, the whole planet, imagine the level of social control that's would be required to do something like that. And so that's why they want to sort of prep us on these things. That's the stuff that worries me more than some of the kind of airy-fairy predictions that they're making about 3D printed hearts and things like that, which may or may not happen. That would be interesting if we could actually do that. But that's part of what the kind of mystique, I think, of the World Economic Forum is, that it mixes a lot of kind of happy-clappy sort of techno-optimism and techno-utopianism about the wonderful world that's right around the corner with a message that's primarily designed to make sure that people, like the people that come together at the World Economic Forum, are given more power to make us all live better lives and for our own good, presumably, which is, I think that's the most sinister aspect of what they're doing. They're trying to convince us that people like that need to be telling the rest of us what to do.
It kind of sounds like instead of like calling it the Great Reset, it sounds like the Great Exchange. Like, I'm going to have to exchange some of my freedoms. Like, can I own a car, or can I go and eat meat if I want to? But as I sacrifice or exchange these things, then I'm becoming a good person because I'm helping these refugees because there's this huge climate crisis that's pending. Like, is it part of that, like this request for an exchange?
Well, and so you invoke this term, the Great Reset, which is another one of Schwab's books, came out July of 2020, I think. And the sort of idea was that what COVID did is it was sort of an opportunity. So it showed us, first of all, one, that people are really compliant if they're afraid that there's a health scare, which surprised me, but almost the entire world willingly locked down, didn't go to worship, didn't go to church, didn't go to their jobs in many cases. And so I think people like Klaus Schwab looked at that and said, wow, you know, I mean, this is the opportunities for social change are really, really profound. And now we'll have a Great Reset. Now, in his case, what they're thinking is we need this Great Reset to a fundamentally different sort of form of energy or something like that. The problem is that we don't actually have an alternative on hand. So even if it were true that we were really causing problems with the planet, we're not. The rate of warming is quite modest. It is not going to lead to any catastrophes. But even if that were true, what we should be doing is trying to find a real alternative rather than trying to figure out ways to control what people do and how much energy they can use and what kind of food they can eat. I mean, my word, that's what markets and prices are for. If things get scarce, if meat were to get scarce because of demand or something like that, or if climate really affected our agriculture, well, guess what? The price of meat would go up and people would adjust the kinds of things that they eat. But that's not what they're talking about. What they want is this kind of social political revolution in which people are just sort of weaned off of their presumably wasteful lifestyles so that they can do what apparently they're supposed to do. Now, I suspect that they're still eating plenty of meat at those Davos banquets, but I have not yet been invited to one, so I can't verify that.
Right? So I'm like, how far does this go? Like, do they take my shoes? Do I have to rent my shoes along with renting my car? Because I have a lot of shoes. Like, I'm just trying to understand.
So is this kind of, I mean, a few examples pop to my mind, which I'm hearing more and more about, which it makes me wonder if it's somewhat connected to this vision, like 15-minute cities that are popping up all over as to being, you know, you should work and live and shop in one area that you can walk to, you know, in 15 minutes. And this is kind of connected to the climate conversation. Would that be the kind of thing that the WEF is pushing?
Well, they'd love to see that. And so think of the World Economic Forum. It doesn't have any political power on its own. What it is a forum, but it is a forum for people that have their own forms of power, either literal political power in the case of heads of state, major philanthropists, former CEOs, people like Bill Gates, for instance, or CEOs of current major corporations, all of whom have certain kinds of power, either political or economic, right? And in some cases, cultural or a famous Hollywood star, for instance, has a type of power. But they don't have, the World Economic Forum can't get together and sort of vote these things. On the other hand, the General Assembly of the United Nations can, you know, we can have, we can end up with treaties that the countries sign off on, for instance. Companies can decide that they're going to implement investment strategies according to, ESG metrics, for instance, which are essentially political metrics rather than business metrics. And then governments themselves, of course, can exercise their own political power. What I think the kind of important thing to understand about organizations like the World Economic Forum is not that there is one guy, like Klaus Schwab, the puppet master, controlling everyone, but that what it is, what's in some ways more scary is that thousands of people from different cultures and religions and industries all seem to think exactly alike and simultaneously, so that whatever sort of popular thing happens to be the next big thing, if it's climate change, that's going to be the thing. If it's transhumanism and everything being automated, that's going to be the next big thing. That the fact that everyone sort of thinks in the same way in this kind of intellectual orthodoxy, that's the thing that to me is, that's sort of spookier and creepier than the sort of classic idea that you've got three people behind the scenes controlling everything.
That's super helpful and clarifying. So when I hear about the rise of crickets being used in food or flour as a flour alternative, I shouldn't think automatically that Klaus Schwab is somehow the puppet master behind that, but rather what he's running is becoming kind of an aggregate of people that all sort of think in a similar way.
Exactly. That's exactly how I would see it. Think of Klaus Schwab is like, well, we don't have these, but they used to have dipsticks in cars, right? They could kind of one piece of information, sort of a proxy for elite secular opinion around the world. So if you want to say globalist elite opinion, Klaus Schwab, he is your guy. He speaks in this kind of business school technocratic, a progressive language. And this isn't global Marxism. What it is, think of it as global corporatism. Corporatism is a kind of a softer form of fascism. If fascism is the economic system that involves a state controlling the private sector and private businesses, corporatism is just kind of the fusing of the political sector and the business sector. And that's exactly what you see, except in this case, there's a third sector, that is a civil society or philanthropic sector. What you should actually want is different sectors of society doing their own job, sometimes just doing different things, sometimes competing, not cooperating. I don't want Walmart and Target cooperating. That would be collusion. I want them competing for customers, right? The idea that all the most powerful institutional individual actors on the planet should be getting together and cooperating, that itself just ought to strike people that believe in the fall as a kind of scary and creepy proposition. And it's especially creepy when you realize that they think that human civilization needs to completely change its way of operating. We got to transform the form of energy that we use, the way we work. And as you said, Krista, the way we eat, we need to change our protein consumption. And so that's what all this bug talk is about, is they're grooming us to think in a particular way.
So you said something early on that I thought was really interesting about the corporatism and bringing in like the corporate side, but then you have the philanthropic side and like all of these things. Is that why we would see someone like Bill Gates giving suggestions, medical suggestions
about vaccines?
About vaccines?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, this is something that, of course, people that write about economics and politics know about this. We often will use the word cronyism. Cronyism is a good example of this would be, let's say, the Food and Drug Administration, which is responsible for basically approving or not approving the safety of drugs, where someone that's at one point they're serving on the Food and Drug Administration, and then the next year they're on the board of trustees of a drug company that's being regulated by the FDA. That's the kind of cronyism in which the regulators and the entities that are getting regulated seem to be part of a kind of revolving door operation. That's cronyism. Corporatism is this kind of larger, really organized effort in which you combine large private corporations with the state and with regulators, and then these philanthropists. So, for instance, the World Health Organization is that's the medical agency of the United Nations. And yet one of the main donors of the World Health Organization, you'd assume that it would just be other member states, is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, strangely enough, and the Wellcome Trust in the UK, which is the sort of equivalent. And so this is already happening. There's already this kind of form of collusion between these different social actors. I think the reason the World Economic Forum gets so much attention is that it's just sort of on an audacious display, because folks are flying in their private jets, paying $19,000 per ticket if they're just attending, or much more than that if they're a member company, and then lecturing the rest of us about the impending doom because of climate change.
No, we shouldn't have cars.
And yet they all managed to come in on their private jets. Yeah. That's why you don't think of this as Marxism or communism. This is something else.
I'd always heard in church, like, go and make disciples, and they'd always say that verse, and I'm like, I don't really know what that looks like at all. And then when I got here, they taught me like everything I was curious to know about, like progressive Christianity and how to talk to an atheist and how to go about witnessing to someone without it being overly preachy or insincere, and that helped me so much.
It's just been such an awesome week, going through these questions and really diving into them. And not just with me, but other Christians. It's not like an individual thing, it's a together thing. We're really strengthening our relationship with the Lord personally, but also together.
We have been given the greatest gift. We have been given life. And Propel has really made me realize once again how important it is to share that gift with the millions of people out there who don't have that gift that's just ripe for the taking.
The WEF is often confused with Marxism, communism, socialism, and that's not exactly true. So we shouldn't think of the WEF as being the same thing as social Marxists in our country who have an active agenda try to fundamentally transform the public school system.
Absolutely.
These are not the same thing. So we should probably talk about that, and then why I also want to get into ESGs and BlackRock and Vanguard and how all of that fits together.
Absolutely. And I mean, the way to think of this is we're going to give them a name. So the kind of transnational globalists or elitists, they see themselves as the alternative to socialism and Marxism. So think about when the Soviet Union collapsed, or in 1990, 91, the Eastern Bloc countries in Europe suddenly gained their freedom. What happened there? We sort of imagine, okay, so now everyone is going to become a kind of traditional small government conservative, and they're going to support free enterprise. The reality is that what happened is that there were a lot of kind of left-wing elites that were never actually committed to the kind of Marxist vision, but they're nevertheless secularist and they're leftists. And they gain power in institutions like the European Union and in the governments of a lot of the new countries, unfortunately, in Europe. These are the people that walk the halls at the UN. These are the people that attend forums like the World Economic Forum. And they imagine themselves as the alternative to the kind of violent revolutionaries that we see sometimes in the United States on the streets. Now, at the same time, there's a kind of cross-fertilization between these two groups of people, I would say. So you can combine them when you're thinking they both have essentially a secularist vision of the world. They tend to be materialist. They will allow a kind of religiosity, as you'll see in the World Economic Forum. They're not going to bring in a Southern Baptist pastor from Alabama or a super conservative archbishop to give a prayer, but they will bring in, you know, maybe a shaman from some kind of animistic religion, which in some ways shows you that they sort of treat religion as, well, it's this kind of interesting kind of local native thing that some people do. And so we'll bring them in and let them play some drums and burn some smoke. But they're overwhelmingly secular and secularist. And you can see this in I'd say the kind of the court intellectual of the World Economic Forum, which is Yuval Noah Harari, who is this Israeli futurist and historian who's written a number of very influential books. He speaks almost every year at the World Economic Forum. Klaus Schwab seems to love what he has to say. His view is the kind of political and metaphysical view, I would say, of most of the people that walk these halls at these organizations.
Okay, that's helpful. So you think that most of them are probably secularists, naturalists,
right,
if you will. Whereas in the, for technically socialists, communists, they're trying to get to more toward violent revolution as a social change. The WEF is more about these intellectuals and partnerships with corporations and nation leaders and kind of building these webs of partnerships and nonprofits and everything.
That's right. And cooperation. And so, okay. I mean, because in some ways it's the sort of left wing of the West, which is not socialist or Marxist. But that's why they talk in these sort of flowery terms about cooperation and interdependency and things like this. They're still on the left, I think, if you're sort of going to use the left-right spectrum to describe political views. Think of it as corporatism, if you want a name, a technical term that's been discussed for decades, which is just an economic and political model in which you have cooperation. And I think of a big blob of corporations and state actors and civil society actors.
Well, let's talk a little bit about ESGs and so what sometimes is called a social credit score.
Yes.
And then I did a live stream last June where I just looked through, for example, on the Human Rights Campaign website, all of the corporations, and I mean, there were hundreds. I mean, I was scrolling and scrolling and scrolling that really care about having a good ESG social credit score. Mm-hmm. And this helps them look appealing to secular progressives, like they are working for the good of others, as secular progressives define it. BlackRock and Vanguard are big, from what I understand, kind of investment companies that own huge percentages in a lot of these big companies. And so, you know, a thought has kind of rose up about this is that BlackRock and Vanguard are kind of acting almost as puppet masters in a way to these corporations. So can you talk to us a little bit, because I know you have some background in economics and that sort of thing. Like explain what's happening there.
Yeah, what's happening is essentially, so ESG stands for environment, social, and governance. But the buzzwords you hear are things like sustainability. And so the idea is that rather than what a traditional company did, it has a board of directors, and a board of directors has a fiduciary responsibility, the CEO. has a responsibility. Fiduciary responsibility means to represent the interests of the shareholders. The shareholders are the people that in a public company actually own parts of the company. And so their job is to make sure the company, you know, obviously obeys the law, but that it produced something that ideally can make a profit, which is a signal that they're producing value. So that's the kind of normal way a company works. ESG is the idea that there ought to be these other metrics. They won't necessarily say, well, companies need to lose money. They're not going to say something that stupid, but there need to be these other kind of social metrics in which we're not just talking about shareholders, but stakeholders. And so, of course, the stakeholders might be the customers. They might be the employees of the company. They might be the animals nearby. They might be the water or the earth. And all these things sort of need to be considered. And so any sustainable company is going to be a company that takes all of these things into account. Well, of course, it gets very, very hard to say, okay, exactly how do you measure the sort of benefit to all this expanding group of stakeholders, which ends up basically meaning that a private company has to sort of do the bidding of people that have absolutely no stake in the success of the company at all, which is what it actually means. This would just all have been silliness, except for the fact that it got really, really popular. And so, as you said, BlackRock and Vanguard, they're these two massive funds. I mean, you could sort of think of it as entities that bundle and buy and sell huge assets, including parts of other companies. And so once they then add not just sort of profitability and basic rules of accounting and truth telling and the kinds of things that you would expect from a company, but these much more airy-fairy ESG metrics, and then these massive funds that can literally tank your company if they were to sort of sell it at an inopportune time, all of a sudden companies have an incentive to appear, at least in window dressing, to be adhering to these ESG metrics. And so that's part of what's happened. And so you could say some of the companies that are doing this are doing it purely for kind of marketing and window dressing. But there's also the reality that many of these companies have themselves been infiltrated by people that have this ideology. I mean, it's not even an open secret that human resources departments and corporations are often absolutely filled with ideologues that are committed to this sort of thing. And so the idea that you all these corporations and these CEOs are all sort of right-wing capitalists or something, it might have been true at one point. It's not true anymore. I mean, what you're much more likely to see in a C-suite of a multinational corporation is the same kind of progressive corporatist conventional thinking that you would see from, say, a leading political elite in France or Belgium.
So would you say then that ESG scores may not be intrinsically part of the WEF agenda, but it's another example of like-minded, secular progressives, corporatists who think a certain kind of a way, and so they broadly fall under the umbrella of sympathetic people who are trying to make the world a better place?
Absolutely. And okay. ESG in particular, I mean, that is a calling card that you will see at the World Economic Forum. ESG, the term actually came out of an agency of the United Nations, but it's since kind of just become the buzzword. But it is absolutely a part of the vision of the World Economic Forum, which spends a lot of time talking about sustainability. And of course, that's a buzzword for the idea that certain ways of doing business are unsustainable in the sense that they use up more resources than they produce or something like that. Of course, a business that's genuinely unsustainable, there's a way to take care of that. They go broke, right? And so if they're unsustainable, they go broke, and there's a way to take care of that in the market. But in this claim, it's usually something having to do with some kind of computer model making predictions about what the sort of environmental effects of certain activities is going to be. And so it gets very, very vague and very, very squishy, but become a kind of an endless excuse for elites, whether they're someplace like the United Nations or elsewhere, to control the private sector and also to control individuals.
I want to go back to like the beginning, because you said in the second question we asked, you were like, I don't want to get into all the sinister things. Well, I am here for the sinister. I'm wondering, when you think about the WEF and the historic Christian worldview, Like, how do those things align? Is it okay for Christians to embrace certain ideals of the WEF?
Because there's been prominent evangelicals who have...
Rick Warren!
Who have participated in this.
Sorry, I wasn't going to say that.
No, I wasn't.
But I did.
Francis Collins.
Yep.
The thing that happened this last year with the shaman blowing on people, one of the people that he blew on was a woman named Catherine Hayhoe, who is, and I believe she would call herself an evangelical scholar. She specializes in climate issues.
Right.
So there have been people, prominent people, who have participated in WEF meetings in the past. But like you said, your boss was on the stage and is obviously not sympathetic to the WEF. So help us start to think about participation.
Yeah. Should we be concerned, not concerned?
Well, and so you got to look at what's, I mean, I could say until very recently, I'm just going to, this is just my opinion. Francis Collins was himself a problematic person from the very beginning. I am very thankful. I never bought the story that he was a great, you know, sort of person to have. As the head of the NIH, yes, he's a self-identified evangelical, but if you read his book, The Language of God, it was clear that his main goal was to sell Orthodox Darwinism to evangelicals. He sat atop a National Institutes of Health that was very anti-life, frankly, and its use of experiments with human embryos. It funded stuff that we're now dealing with pediatric gender medicine, and so if there was a benefit to having evangelical at the head of the NIH, I'm not exactly sure what it was. And so I think the World Economic Forum would love to be able to co-opt certain people that have a sort of fair, you know, a sort of conservative profile. That's beneficial to them. Look, I mean, the president of the World Economic Forum right now is a former leader of the Norwegian Conservative Party. So that you got to kind of account for that there's always going to be the possibility they're going to try to co-opt someone. I think what happened in 2024, especially with the invitation to Kevin Roberts and to President Milei, is that they did actually realize, okay, it's getting obvious, guys, that we're doing this. So let's actually invite a couple of people that are critics of ours, not evangelicals. They're going to play nice and breathe the smoke from the shaman, but people that have actually publicly criticized us and might criticize us here. And that's exactly what happened. I'll be interested to see if they continue to do that. I think the fact that they even thought to do it this year shows that they are sort of feeling some heat, because they get critics, of course, those of us on the right that have been longtime critics, but they have some critics on the sort of far left as well, who criticize their obvious hypocrisy in which they, you know, just the flying of the jet planes while they lecture us about climate change, for instance.
From a worldview standpoint, would you say that the agenda of the WEF is out of step or in conflict with the historic Christian worldview, or is it compatible? Help us kind of understand this a little bit worldviewishly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the best way, if we're going to distill it, people should go online and watch a couple of lectures from Yuval Noah Harari. So he's an author, an Israeli scholar. He's a gay, vegan, atheist, Israeli historian. Talk about the next 30 or 40 years. He's predicting that, first of all, machines will become sentient, or computers will become sentient. We will, before too long, because of sort of technological advancements, will ultimately abandon this mortal coil for more durable hardware. We'll unite with our technology. You can just put it simplistically, we'll upload ourselves to the internet, and we'll have a kind of technological form of immortality. That's obviously not what Christians believe with the kingdom of God and the resurrection of the body. And in fact, Harari has a famous statement, and I think that this is in his book, Homo Deus. He said, history began when humans invented God, and it will end when we become gods. His idea doesn't mean that literally. He's an atheist, so he doesn't believe there are gods, but he actually thinks that the sort of the moment in human evolution, as he would put it, when people started to tell stories that gave them significance and talked about gods and purposes in nature. That's what that created civilization, created religions. It actually made us more creative. So he actually thinks there's a kind of Darwinian selective advantage in us telling these false mythological stories, inventing gods, though he thinks it's entirely false. But he thinks we're ultimately destined to ourselves become much more like the gods that we made up at an earlier stage of our evolution. So he is a full-on radical transhumanist who expects us to transcend our biological forms sometime in the next, I don't know, 40 or 50 years. I mean, he states this almost with the degree of certainty of, you know, a weather forecaster telling us what's going to happen day after tomorrow.
Do you think that the issue of other, the mindset of, for example, I don't know like how to put it, but I'm thinking about the Tower of Babel, and, you know, yes. It seems like there's sort of a warning there from God about coordinating too much, of human efforts, and exactly. That he engages in a forced program of separating powers, if you will. This concerns me about the WEF.
Krista, that is the perfect, I think, analogy, honestly, is the Tower of Babel, because that's what the Tower of Babel is about. It's this attempt of humans, in a literal sense, build a tower to reach heaven, to reach the gods, but also to work together to achieve something divine that they're not supposed to achieve. And so God actually scattered the peoples in the Tower of Babel. That's the kind of spirit that I think you should associate with something like the World Economic Forum. I mean, we live in a moment in which a type of human cooperation is now possible. I mean, this is why COVID happened, and it's why gender ideology can spread all around the planet. It was only in 2007 that the smartphone was invented. It was only in August of 2010 that most people in the developed world really finally had access to kind of real-time streaming video. Now, a majority of the planet has real-time access at roughly the speed of light to high-definition video, so that a bad idea can spread around the planet in a number of minutes. And so the opportunities for cooperation in a sense, but also for a kind of collusion and for control, I think have never been greater than they are right now. And so I think that's precisely the kind of thing that we should be worried about, because that's all this talk about cooperation and interdependence and things like that. That's a nice way of covering over what is in fact a heck of a lot of colluding of a lot of very influential and very powerful people behind the scenes.
It also strikes me that this level of kind of global cooperation doesn't seem consistent with what scripture talks about the human condition, and that we humans have been deeply marred and polluted by sin. And we often don't act in ways that are truly just and fair. And so we need checks and balances to help keep evil in check. And maybe I'm missing something, but it seems like the WEF operates on a principle that people will act in certain altruistic ways in order to gravitate toward their vision of the common good.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, this is something that I would say is common among the kind of globalist elites and Marxist, in that they tend not to take the givenness of human nature seriously, and they don't take the universality of the fall seriously. In fact, I don't even think it kind of figures in their thinking at all. The genius of the American experiment, you talked about checks and balances. Checks and balances is a type of cooperation, but it's a type of cooperation in which you set people's interests against each other, so that the three branches of government, you have the legislative and the judicial and the executive, they're actually supposed to compete. They combine because they each want to have more power than they can have, but they balance that out so that they're forced to cooperate. in order to get anything done, but not one of them can have too much power. That's the genius of the American experiment, that we have a federated system in which you have 50 states rather than a single unitary government. And there's another set of people, and you see them at the United Nations, and you see them at places like the World Economic Forum, in which they think, they either say this because it's cynical, or they really believe that we had this global crisis in which we're going to run out of food, we're going to run out of resources, we're going to burn up the planet. So we have to all cooperate in this one sort of global cause. And that's what they want to do. They may believe it sincerely or not, but that is a scary prospect. And that's something that we absolutely should resist. I just think if we're going to resist it well, we need to understand exactly what's happening. And if we imagine that it has to do with three guys controlling everything, that's way too simple. This is think of it as a sort of hive mind in which there's a lot of elite people all just thinking exactly the same thoughts.
So when it comes to the regular person in the pews, in our churches, do you think that this sort of globalist, technocrat, corporatist approach should be something we should try to resist? Should we be concerned if our pastors start talking about things from a global perspective? You know, like at what point? Because here's where my question is coming from. Like 6 years ago, most people had never heard of critical race theory. Right. But in their pulpits, they were being conditioned into thinking about certain terms like privilege, white privilege, thinking about redefining racism according to critical race theory. But they weren't even aware that there was this framework back there that was infiltrating their church. And they just noticed that their pastor started using different words. And why are we talking about this? And they were getting conditioned to think a certain way. Should we have a concern about that when it comes to globalism, that what may seem like an innocent thing of like, hey, I'm not racist. I don't want to be for racism. So yeah, I'm going to talk about anti-racism, not understanding Kendi and all of that behind it. Should we have a similar concern about this issue?
Absolutely. I mean, it's all the same kind of cluster of issues, unfortunately. I'm glad that the World Economic Forum and Klaus Schwab are getting more attention now. But the reality is, I think you're right, Krista, that there is a temptation. This is true in evangelical circles. It's true in Catholic circles, in which religious leaders who themselves want, they want to be what C.S. Lewis said. Everybody kind of wants to be in the inner ring. They want to be brought into the kind of center of influence and power. And so there's something heady if you're say the head of a Christian denomination and you get invited to one of these things. I mean, gosh, that strokes your ego, and you might genuinely believe you could have some influence, but there's the other danger that you're actually going to be co-opted. And so, I'm glad we're talking about this, because I think, look, if you're sitting in the pew and your pastor is talking this way and using these strange terms, if you start hearing ESG or you hear sustainability or this is some of these buzzwords, your spidey sense ought to go off that something might be happening there.
Like for example, we were in a meeting back in like 2020 or 2021 of a major Christian university that everybody would know the name of. And they were rolling out their DEI program, and on their website, they had all these words like stakeholders and lots of words that I hear affiliated with the WEF. And then I'm starting to think like, wait, I'm starting to hear these types of words coming into our vocabulary, the degrowth thing and climate, consciousness, and it's being rebranded under Christian ideas as creation care. Well, I want to care about creation. That's for me. But then I'm buying $14 light bulbs and I can't really figure out why. So to me, I'm just trying to begin to think about how to help people resist this, you know, when you see an Amish person on the news who's mm-hmm. who's being ticketed or harassed by local officials because of their cows and, you know, farming practices. But then I also yeah. see that happening in Europe. Like, the regular person is going to have to push back. But that's I'm also right. concerned about Christians in the pews having their pastors be co-opted by this.
Yeah, I think it's that is a real worry. I mean, I think that the hope for resistance on this is going to be, well, partly not every country, including some countries that are not really good actors, are not really on board okay. with the World Economic Forum vision. So that's sort of the good news. They don't like this either. But the truth of the matter is, I suspect 95% of the world's population wouldn't like this if they knew about it. It's like the crazy gender madness that, again, has found its way into all these transnational organizations who are now pushing this stuff. The vast majority of the world's population hates it or would hate it if they knew about it. And so in some ways, it's just a matter of educating people about what's going on.
Okay.
And helping them understand how this is, okay, it has some relationship with the kind of fights that we had in the 20th century against Marxism and communism, but it's morphed into something that's in some ways more complicated, because it's really simple. If, look, the government owns everything and tells you what to do, well, you know who the bad actor is. But what do you do when sort of behind the scenes you've got philanthropists and you've got heads of state and you've got corporations all sort of cooperating and all using the same kind of weird coded language that don't ever remember being debated or defended? Everybody just kind of started using it.
There's a question not the one on Facebook, the one on YouTube from Melissa, and she's just asking, how are Amish people under fire? And if I'm understanding correctly, it is because of the climate control conversation and things like animals like cows giving off certain gases yeah. and things like that, then they would need to bring that under control. And in order to bring that under control, you would need to kill off so many cows, or you wouldn't be able to have as many like livestock, not just cows, but livestock.
Well, because they want to make farm. The thought or the ethos is about making meat more rare. And, you know, but I think if people don't come away from anything else in this conversation, I think it's hugely clarifying to understand the WEF doesn't make laws, and it's not just controlling the world by this tiny oligarchy of Klaus Schwab and maybe a couple of his close associates. Rather, it's a reflection of the secular progressive ideology, and it kind of acts as a gathering sort of mechanism of like-minded
exactly.
people.
A gathering mechanism and an amplifier in which you get a really nice kind of distillation of what these are. Conversations happening in meetings and embassies and forums and cocktail parties around the world. The nice thing about the World Economic Forum is that it's public, it's online. You can hear them saying these things.
That's good. Well, this has been super helpful, Jay. Why don't you talk to us about your newest book that just came out in February? We want to give you a strong opportunity to be able to talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. It's called Fight the Good Fight: How an Alliance of Faith and Reason Can Win the Culture War. I wrote it with my friend James Robison. And it is our argument for how we can create a new coalition of people that includes Christian social conservatives and Orthodox Jews, but also just anti-woke liberals and classical liberals and people that thought of themselves as leftist until 5 or 10 years ago, and they are awakened because of critical race theory or because of gender ideology, feel like they're politically homeless. This is the kind of coalition of people I have experienced in my fight over the last 3 years over gender ideology. I think that the public culture is getting so deranged that lots of people that might not have agreed with the social conservatives until a few years ago are all of a sudden waking up. And so it's really a kind of program for people. If you can only read one book to try to understand the political issues that are involved and how to make the case for conservative things to maybe your unbelieving neighbor, that's what the book is about. And we managed to pack it all into about 60,000 words. And if you're curious about anything from trade to how that make the case for marriage or climate change, actually, it's in the book.
Very good. And I'm going to give a personal shout out to Jay's book, Money, Greed, and God. I read the book a couple of months ago and found it super helpful. I think it would be a great book for a high school worldview class, or like a homeschool co-op, or a entry-level college econ class. But it's very accessible in talking about comparing and contrasting the free market system with socialism in just very, very basic language. And so that's, I know it's a little bit older book, but it's, I think it's a helpful book. Jay, as we sign off here, I'm wondering if we could just talk for a minute. We've been talking about in the WEF, this idea of doing things for the kind of the common good, you know, the good of all people. But that idea of the common good, from what I understand, comes out of kind of Catholic social political philosophy. Yeah. And I know you're a Catholic, and so maybe you could kind of help us understand what that term common good has historically or classically meant, and contrast that with what it has morphed into.
Yeah, and so the common good is sort of the good of, there are different common goods, actually. So if you think about, okay, what is good for you as an individual? It helps you prosper and flourish. What's good for your family? So the things that you say, what would be good for my family would be a common good, and then the common is the family. Same thing, you say, what's the good of the town? Like the overall benefits for the town. And in the Catholic understanding of common good, it can never subordinate the lower level good. So you're not going to have something that's sort of the good of the nation. So let's say the common is the entire United States of America. It can't be a good if it destroys the goods of families and individuals. And so it's the sort of not just the sum total, but it takes up a genuine good of everyone. Unfortunately, common good, when you hear it used, unless it's being used in that precise sense, is usually just another one of these vague terms where the idea is that, well, that you might like to do that for yourself, but the common good actually requires that you not do the things that you think you ought to pursue. That's usually being used as a euphemism for social control over lower social groups like families, churches, and individuals, unfortunately. And that's how many of these terms, they might have originally had a perfectly defensible and good sense, but they tend to get co-opted. And unfortunately, I think that's what's happened with the word common good.
So when people hear that term common good, it will be important to inquire about a definition and what that means, and not just assume everybody in the room shares the same standard of good.
Yeah. Exactly.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. All right, Jay, thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it. It's been a wonderful conversation and super
great
helpful.
To be with you. Thanks so much. God bless.
Thanks.
God
bless. Bye.
Okay. Dr. Jay Richards, everyone.
Look at you. You made it.
I know. That was so helpful. I learned some things.
I know, right?
He gave me some things to think about that I didn't know before. Such an honor to have him on. And there's about four more topics that I would love to talk to him about. But I just think that his work is just, he's so clear and accessible. Even though he is an academic, he communicates in a way that I feel like I can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I did want to look at on Facebook.
Yeah, let's look at some comments.
Susie John Graham's question.
Yeah.
She says, will the citizens of this society be able to vote for representation? Well, I know you also, because we talked about it just a little while ago, the way that the WEF is set up, it's not set up to rule over necessarily
over
like
countries,
the United States,
right,
or over Mexico. It is a big, it's one of my, do you see me?
I know. I was trying to get his attention. I don't know what happened to your monitor when we're
okay. I'm just making sure. But that they are an interconnected web.
Right.
For the common good of all the countries. And so you would,
it's
for
like
all the people.
It's like-minded individuals from different countries. They're all bound together by the ideology of being a secular progressive.
Yes, but that doesn't mean that those people necessarily rest in government.
Right.
Like Bill Gates doesn't rest in government.
Right.
And so we would still, as long as other things don't take place, we would still have a government that we would vote for.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. So I tried to incorporate all your questions as I was watching them in the stream and tried to incorporate them into the discussion as we went along. It looked like they were having a very lively discussion there on YouTube. And we hope you found this helpful as kind of a crash course or introduction to the World Economic Forum and understanding it better. I know for me, the thing I learned that makes sense to me, but I wasn't really consciously aware of it, is that Klaus Schwab is not trying to be like the Emperor Palpatine of the world government.
That's kind of what I was thinking too, because I was thinking like it's just this one world order.
Right.
But it's not.
Yeah.
But it low-key kind of is.
But it's the ideology is.
It's this one shared ideology across all the countries, but it's not necessarily one main guru over all the countries as one head leader.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was a big kind of insight for me. Also, just understanding more about the worldview and the role and cooperation, as he said many times, of national leaders plus corporations plus nonprofits, but they're all united under this umbrella of the secular progressive ideals. And so when we see similarities there, it's because they're all talking to each other. Mm-hmm. All these elites are in a room having a conversation with each other, and they all share the same worldview.
I wish we had more time, because two of the questions that I would have loved to ask that I'm only thinking about now.
Oh, I wouldn't have signed off with him. I didn't know you had more questions.
Well, they came now.
Oh, okay.
Now that I'm processing.
Okay.
Is one, how do we see the WEF, how do we see their hand in less developed countries or on less developed like continents, you know, like Africa?
Coming in, like how we talked about last week.
How do we see that? You know, is their hand, because when we think about Bill and Melinda Gates and the Gates Foundation, they're the ones who are responsible for the abortion situation, especially in Upper Africa, but all the way down into Southern Africa as well. Or what is the penalty? So let's say I opt out. Like, I don't want to rent your car, and I don't want to rent your shoes, and I don't want no drone delivering my milk. Like,
I want to own a car, own my house, and
own my shoes. I especially want to own my shoes. So what's the penalty for that? Like, if you tell me I can only have two pairs of shoes, and I got to get rid of at least 75 more, like, what am I supposed to do with that? Because I feel like those are fighting words.
Yeah.
I personally won't fight.
So someone on the stream, for example, said they live in a 15-minute city and they enjoy it. Well, I don't have a problem with a 15-minute city in principle, as long as that's not the end goal to force everyone to live in a 15-minute city. And there's freedom for, as Jay said, competing choices.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they want to build a 15-minute city and some people want to opt into that, great. But if I don't want to opt into that, then there needs to be other competing ideas. So, yeah, that's my thought about that.
I'm not here for Kimba today. Your shoes won't fit in the tiny house that's 65 sensors to monitor. See, I can't do a tiny house. Like, let's just be honest. I have very strong feelings and opinions about tiny homes. And if you love them, go for it. You do.
But that's the competition.
All of you.
We should have competing options.
We should. And my competing option has to at least be like 2,500 square feet. I know I live by myself. Okay. But as long as I got mine, don't worry about me and what I do.
Yeah.
But if you want to live in a tiny house and you want your washing machine, dryer, dishwasher, and stove to be all within the same appliance, may the Lord bless you and keep you.
Yeah.
I can't do it.
So hopefully this helped people kind of, I think my hope with all of this is that it'll help you interpret the news a little bit better when you see things about why is an Amish farmer being harassed about his cows? Well, okay, that goes to the secular progressive idea about climate issues. Why am I all of a sudden seeing crickets as an alternative to flour? Oh, okay, it's because of this. So that we understand what we're choosing. And hey, if you want to eat crickets, that's fine.
Crickets are not an alternative to flour.
Just make sure that I don't have to eat
crickets.
Someone
is lying to you. They are not. I don't care how fine you ground them up. They are not an alternative. It's a bug. And with that, people, that's it. Because we're done. That's a roll.
All right. So remember, we're dark next week because it's Holy Saturday. We hope you have a blessed Resurrection Sunday. And we will see you back here in 2 weeks for a live show with our friend Tim Barnett from Standard Reason, Mr. Red Pen Logic. He just recently co-authored a book with our friend Elisa Childers. We're going to be talking about Tim's ministry on TikTok and his reach and how he stumbled into all of that, but also some inspiration maybe for the rest of us about how to pray for young people, how to pray for those who are deconstructing, and also maybe it will inspire a couple of you who might watch the show to think about TikTok as a mission field. But we will have Tim here to talk about what he is doing with his interesting mission there to young people.
And just want to give a reminder that on Sunday, Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, it is Krista Bontrager's birthday. Happy early birthday to you, since we will not be here next week. We love you very much and all your shenanigans. Thank you for being with us, everyone. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Have a great rest of your weekend and a great rest of your week.
God bless.
Thanks for listening to All the Things. Be sure to subscribe to our website at allthethingsshow.com and find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you stream your podcast. Be sure to hit that subscribe button and the bell so you'll receive alerts when we post new shows. We'll see you next week.